afternoon. Welcome back to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Well, our guest this hour is the new governor of the state of Minnesota. Jesse Ventura was officially sworn in yesterday. Today he is spending his first full day as Minnesota's 38th or 37th governor, depends on how you count. This morning he held a reception for Minnesota legislators. This noon, it's your turn to talk with the governor, so we sure invite you to give us a call. Our Twin City area number, 651-227-6000. Time to get used to the new area codes, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Governor, thanks for coming in today.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be here today. My pleasure.
Now, I haven't seen you for a couple of months.
Since you predicted my victory here.
Well, actually, it was right after you won, so I was on. I did go out on a limb then. Now, okay. You look the same. Do you feel the same now that you're the official governor?
Yeah, I really do. It's I can't change who I am. I've got to stay the same person. It's the old thing. You do what brought you here. And so I'm going to stay the same person, probably wear suits a little more than I'd care to. But then again, I can dress the way I want to now. I don't have to seek re-election or do any of that. So jeans and T-shirt might be the uniform of the day at a few times here, too, also, because I'm very comfortable that way with tennis shoes and jeans and T-shirt.
How did it feel yesterday to take the official oath? I mean, after all this long build-up and all the surprises of the year and... Finally, yesterday, you raised your hand.
Actually, it was a relief because it's been so hectic from November 3rd, where truly your life gets turned upside down, even beyond what I believed it could. You know, the night that I won and became the governor-elect. And from that point on, it's been 12 to 14-hour work days, you know, at the Capitol, dealing with commissions, budgets, appointments, getting acclimated, going out to the different departments, meeting the department heads and all that. So it really was almost a relief to go there and now officially be doing what I should be doing. And, you know, I'm going to throw it out because you know how I am. Hypothetically here, if we can for a moment, if either of my two opponents had won, all during that transition, they would have been paid. Mm-hmm. Attorney General, Mayor, they would have continued to collect public salaries, and I guarantee you they couldn't have done their jobs because I just finished this transition period, and it was 12 to 14 hours of focused every day at doing the transition. And again, it's the unlevel playing field to the person in the private sector. I'm unpaid from November 3rd till yesterday. And yet, if either of my opponents had won, they would have been paid for their work. Not really their work. They'd have been paid for what they used to do, just like what I complained about during the election.
Mm-hmm. Why do you suppose there's been so much interest in your inauguration? After the initial shock of November 3rd, I could understand that, but goodness gracious, reporters everywhere, everybody's all agog.
Well, I think it's the fact that I came out of nowhere. No one gave me a chance, if you want to call it the typical Rocky Balboa story, where, you know, they knew I wouldn't quit, they knew I'd give it my all, but no one gave me a chance. All the quote-unquote experts were wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that the underdog story always plays well with the press and the media because it gives them the, you know, something to get their teeth into, and it gives them a great story, and so they've been capitalizing on it. And I think beyond that too, Gary, is the fact that we have the highest voter turnout in the United States, which we can be very proud of here in Minnesota. Still not up to snuff as far as I'm concerned. It could be even higher. And second of all, we brought in so many disenchanted voters, people who had left the system, who had given up on it, as well as, even more than that, this big number of young people. The young people came out and voted in Minnesota more than any other place in the country. So I think it's that phenomena a little bit that has the media very much, and all parts of the world, Japan and all over the world, are looking at this, because as many countries face apathy, all of a sudden here's Minnesota, and that we don't have any lack of apathy going on here right now.
You mentioned that yesterday during your inaugural address, talked about the young people, keeping them involved. how do you do that? I mean, once all the hoopla dies down a little bit and you go back to a fairly routine existence as governor and the legislative
process. You think
so? Well,
you think I can be routine?
Well, we'll see.
We'll find out.
How do you maintain that level of interest?
Well, you of course won't maintain it to the peak level that it was prior to the election and the novelty of it and all that. But we had a meeting, and I talked about this in my address, we brought in 13 citizens across the state of Minnesota that were randomly picked, but not randomly picked. They weren't picked just if they voted for me. That wasn't what we were looking for. Mm-hmm. Tell us why you voted for Jesse Ventura. No, we brought them in. They were either first-time voters or they were people who hadn't voted in 5 consecutive elections. And we brought them in and asked them the question, how do we keep you involved? And their answers were very clear, honesty. And I think in light of what we're watching in Washington today, that is a very big word called being honest. And when they say honest, they were very clear too in saying this doesn't mean we want you to tell us necessarily what we want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
We just want you to be truthful. And another thing was brought out, how they were alienated. They said it's the same thing. Every 4 years, the politicians come out, they give you all this hoorah stuff that you listen to all the way till they get elected. They said then you don't hear another thing about it until 4 years later when they bring up the exact same things again over and over and over again. And they said, we're tired of it.
Lots of callers on the line here, but before we get to our first, I have to ask you one more question. What in the world does huya mean?
Huya?
Yeah.
That's a greeting. That's a greeting, an inner circle greeting of all Navy frogmen and Navy SEALs in the Special Forces Navy community. If an instructor like Chief Moy, who was there yesterday, if he were to drop me for push-ups, the only way I can get recovered and stop doing them and get back to my feet is when I've done whatever the required amount happens to be, I have to give him a hoo-yah, Instructor Moy. And unless that's hoo-yah is accompanied, I'll still be down there doing push-ups. So it's a word, it's a made-up word that maybe it's part of Jesse speak now, and it'll probably become traditional here in Minnesota. But that's where it comes from.
But just to clarify, so you'd be doing, like, say you do your 100 push-ups, and when you got to 100, then you'd yell hoo-yah.
Hoo-yah, Instructor Moy.
And if he didn't yell hoo-yah back,
he would go recover, dummy. And you'd be back on your feet. He doesn't hoo-yah you back.
Oh.
Because you're a trainee. You're a tadpole. You're not a frog, man.
Hoo-yah goes up. It doesn't come back down.
That's right. Pretty much.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest this hour. Jessica, your question for the governor, please.
Hi, Jesse. I have a serious question for you.
Hi, Jessica.
I got to give you a little background first. I'm 20 years old, and in 1998, I married the man of my dreams and had a baby, and we bought our first home. And now my husband works as a full-time program coordinator for a developmentally disabled home, and he makes $8.50 an hour, and he doesn't get any insurance. For us to get insurance for our family, it would cost about $60 less than our mortgage that we pay for our home.
Mm-hmm.
And recently we took our daughter to the doctor because she was constipated. And they said, bring her in. So we took her in, and he charged us $80 to tell us not to feed her rice, apples, or bananas for about a week. And later after we paid the bill, we got a thing in the mail saying that they would waive any money that our insurance company didn't pay that we would owe. And that kind of made me mad because it said that they would have taken $60 for something we paid $80 for. And basically my question is this. I'd like to know why, I know you're kind of against social programs, why wouldn't you support, given our situation, us getting on Minnesota Care or a program that could help us out for a year until my husband, who has a degree in biology, can get a job that maybe will offer us some insurance and make it a little less money for us every month.
Well, I sympathize with you, but again, you have to remember government cannot always be there. Government is not your parent. You know, in decisions you make in life, you have to be able to stand up and accept the responsibility of those decisions and career moves, family planning, and things of all that nature. You make those decisions, and certainly I support government being there to help the people that need the help. But I also want the people to understand that they need to stand on their own 2 feet, and they cannot just be dependent upon government. And what people need to clearly understand is this, And I've said it during the campaign, and I guess obviously I need to continue to say it. Government doesn't create $1 of money. When government gives somebody money, they took that money from someone else. So always remember, if you're receiving something from the government took that from someone else to give to you.
Minnesota Care Program, would you like to see it continued as it is now? Or
I'm not an expert on it. I certainly I think that there has to be a safety net out there, but I also believe in competition, and I believe that in the healthcare industry, by socializing medicine, it might be a good band-aid temporarily, but in the long run, I think it's going to be a major detriment, as it is to me in socializing a lot of things. Competition pushes prices down, not socializing and monopolizing.
Wally, your question, please.
Yes, gentlemen, I'm honored that you'll take my call today. Mr. Ventura, I'm a member of the Highway 55 protest reroute people.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And my question to you, sir, is if they were to show you, if our people, the Midwakit and Dakota people, were to show the state officials new evidence about the reroute and the destruction that's happening down there with the Highway 55, would you, sir, look into the matter? Would you be willing to look into the matter and help the Mendota Midwakitan people, as well as Earth First, keep the reroute out of there to save the sacred spring and our sacred trees?
Keep him on the line.
Okay.
I don't want him cut off.
All right.
First of all, where were you 30 years ago?
30 years ago, sir, I was 10 years old, sir.
Well, my point is this. I lived in the neighborhood and went to Roosevelt High School. 30 years ago, they took down and cleared out Hiawatha Avenue. And these homes that were there, if it's sacred land, why wasn't it protested and made aware that these homes were sitting on sacred land 30 years ago?
That's a good question, sir, that I can't answer, but
I think you need to find me that answer, because it seems to me all of this sacred stuff started about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
And my point is, what's the difference if a house sits on sacred land or a road or highway does?
I understand your point, sir. My comment to you would be that I don't have that information. The elders that I've spoken to have told me that that is sacred land, and I believe them. And my question would be, would you be willing, sir, to sit down and speak to the elders in the Midwakitun Dakota community of that area?
I certainly would entertain the thought of speaking with them, but before I do, they better answer the questions I just asked you.
Because
the other thing is this, we've also been told about these sacred trees that are supposedly 100, 200 years old, and yet scientifically the trees are not that old. So it's impossible for them to be as old as they're being stated as being.
Well, scientifically, they did not take any core samples of those four specific trees that we're trying to protect. So their information saying that those trees cannot be that old is not scientific, because they didn't take any core samples.
Well, if they take a core sample from it, won't it hurt the tree?
That I'm not sure, sir. I'm not a botanist.
And neither am I. But that's what I'm being told by botanists, that they're not as old as what they're being claimed to be. And again, my statement is, why wasn't there protest over the houses being built on this sacred land?
Is there any way, Governor, to... without
supposed sacred land,
without reopening the whole Hiawatha Avenue, is there any kind of middle ground here? Any way to protect what some people view as parkland, land, and still get the road straightened out and get all of that taken care of?
I'm not an engineer. The engineers have worked with it. This supposed spring is not being touched. Mm-hmm. You know, this cold water spring, that's protected. Nothing is going to harm that. It's just a jag over into the road, a jag over with the road. And I have a hard time dealing with this, because then what happens anywhere? Do groups come forward everywhere and call every land we have sacred land? I mean, who deems what's sacred?
Mm-hmm.
What's sacred to one is not sacred to another. And as I said, you know, where was the protesting while all these homes sat on this supposed sacred land for all these years? There were people living there with homes built on this land. Well, if it was sacred, you know, why? Well, why wasn't there protests going on 30, 40 years ago over why these homes were allowed to be built there?
Mm-hmm. Eric, your question, please.
Yes, Mr. Governor. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Eric.
I'm a veteran of the United States Navy. I'm a gunner's mate.
Mm-hmm.
Still in reserves. And I'm also an avid hunter and shooter. What I worry about today in this state is gun control, amongst many other more important things. But I feel that where do we stop with this new act to do a criminal check on rifles and shotguns, as well as as well as handguns?
Well, gun control is not a small thing, because it's protected by our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. So it was a large enough issue that the forefathers of the country saw it as that. I believe that we have the right to bear arms. I've always believed that. The Constitution, Bill of Rights, gives us that right, and I will continue to work for that. But by the same token, we need to keep guns out of the hands of people who have given up their right to bear arms, and those are criminals. But for law-abiding citizens, I'm a firm believer, as a law-abiding citizen, you have every right to bear arms, and they're not just there for hunting and fishing.
Any specific changes you see that you're going to push in terms of state gun laws?
I'm not going to push anything, and a lot of it is federal now today anyway, and I think the current restrictions we have now are plenty. We're overregulated already, and all we have to do is enforce the laws that we have on the books right now, and they'll work just fine. And people need to remember something. Guns truly don't kill anybody. It's the person that pulls the trigger. You know, that's like blaming an automobile. If someone goes out and gets drunk and jumps in a Ford, and I'm just using that as an example, which I have to clarify those things now, Gary, you got to be real careful. But if he jumps into a truck or a car, whatever make or model, Ford, Chevy, whatever it might be, and he's consumed alcohol, and he goes out and kills somebody, drunk driving, do we then blame the companies that build the cars? Absolutely not. That would be ridiculous. So by the same thought process, you can't blame the guns for the acts that stupid humans do. Let's blame the humans. Let's put the blame where it belongs, on the person that pulls the trigger, not the particular instrument that they use to cause the destruction with.
You mentioned DWI. Are you going to support lowering the legal drinking age, or drinking limit, I should say?
Well, my view on that is lowering it from 0.10 to 0.08, it looks good politically. But it's not those people that are killing people out on the roads. It's the people. We need to get tougher drunk driving laws for repeat offenders. These people that time in and time out continue to get drunk, they get caught 8 times. Well, how many times do they really do it? 150, 200? These are just the times they've been caught. We need to get tougher and be like Europe. That's a privilege to drive an automobile. And we need to start saying, this is not a right. This is a privilege that's granted to you. And we need to enforce that when someone loses that privilege, they lose it very severely, because there's no excuse anymore. There's no one on the planet or in the United States of America that doesn't know that if you consume alcohol, you should not get behind the wheel of a car. And we need to be tough. To me, it's not so much on moving 0.02 of a decimal point in there or whatever it is. It's the fact that when someone gets popped, and it's the person that's up about 1.3, 1.4 and higher, that when they get it, that they're dealt with very severely and critically.
Mm-hmm. Rose, Rosemarie, your question for the governor?
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Ventura, Governor Ventura.
Hi, Rose.
My concern for the state is the crisis and the shortage of affordable housing. I'm not one of those people who's real worried at all about getting a tax rebate. I know there's a lot out there who are, but I guess I'd be more excited about seeing some of the money from our state go into housing. There's so many people out there who are, you know, working lots of jobs, working real hard, and there's so very little choices where people can live anymore, people who are not wealthy. I'm wondering how you feel about that. I know one of your priorities is education and taxes and stuff, and education and housing are so closely tied together, you know, with kids having to move all the time and the mobility and the non-stability. What do you think about investing more in housing in the state?
Well, what we need to do is make it attractive for the private sector to do that. the people that build the homes. You know, you've got all the private sector builders out there that earn a living, and they go according to what the market dictates. We have to make it attractive for that marketplace to be in low-income housing. And again, rather than simply making another government program or taking more government money to subsidize things, why not lower taxes? Why not do it from that side of it and make it cost-effective for the builder to build that type of house? If we can make that happen, they will build them then. But you have to make the market has to be a thing that is attractive to the private sector. You cannot just sit and flush money into government programs and government building of everything. Certainly you look at it to a certain point, but then again, if we allow the government to grow and grow and grow and get larger and larger and larger, who foots the bill for the government then? You gotta indulge the private sector and make it attractive for them to build those houses. When that happens, those houses will get built, and that's our job as government, is to make it attractive for the private sector to do that.
Tax rebates, tax cuts, what can we expect?
Well, you can expect surplus money's coming back.
All of it?
Yes. Absolutely. It's surplus. That's above and beyond what was budgeted for the government to operate on. The only thing, all the hoopla came on this over when? Because apparently the legislature, if they've got a few quarters in their pockets, they got to spend them. I don't have that problem, Gary. I mean, I can, whether I give it back immediately or give it back June 30th, I can wait. My point is I want to create policy here. A policy, and I call it again, KISS, keep it simple and stupid. Because people out there in the world, they don't have time to be watchdogging us. They don't have time to be looking over their shoulder. They're busy raising families, going to work, doing what they got to do to survive out there. And by keeping it simple and stupid, if they know that biannually, every June 30th is the end of the fiscal biannual budget, and that's when you balance the checkbook. And if there's a surplus of money, you then know, wow, this is when we'll get it back, if it's there. And that's all I want to do, is create a policy. Not we're going to get a little bit back here in February, and then again we'll give some back in July, and then again in December and all of that. Well, people need to remember it costs money to give money back. You know, it becomes expensive to return that money. In whatever way that you're going to do it. And so that's all I'm trying to do right now. They're going to get all the surplus money back, because I believe very strongly that's what the legislature's there to do, and that's what I'm there to do, is create a budget. When we bring in more revenue than what that budget is, that revenue should go back to the people that put it in there, and the same as any utility company. If they charge you $100 for your electric bill when in reality you should have only paid, you know, $70, well, then you've got $30 coming back on that electric bill. Plain and simple.
Republicans will argue, though, that, you know, the basic point, as long as there is money in the bank, people will come up with legitimate, good programs to spend it on. And then, of course, the rebate will...
Well, then there's a simple thing. It's called no. And then do we need, and this isn't like getting a second definition of is. I don't think we have to worry that there's only one definition of no. And if they want to pass the bill to get it out of the mix right away so that they can't do that, I'm fine with that. I have no problem if they want to make that the first thing that they do. No problem. But I just want to create, again, policy to where it'll come back June 30th, the end of the fiscal year.
Tobacco money, are you going to lump that into what's considered the surplus?
No, I'm separating that, because the tobacco money is the result of a court case. That's not the result. The tobacco money is not the result of overtaxation or surplus budget money. This is court case money. And yes, we could give a one-time give back of that money, that lump sum. It'd come out to about $140 for everybody, roughly, you know, in that general vicinity. But I think this is money that was won through a court case. And I think we can help humanity a lot more by doing some other things with that. One thing I want to do with some of that tobacco money is create a trust or an endowment that will earn money from years to come, and with that earned money that it earns off the principal, I would like to take that money that it earns and put it into health research, both at the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. Because I think here you've got tobacco that has harmed so many people. Well, let's turn this money into a positive for humanity. Let's turn it into a positive to where we can do research to help conquer things like diabetes, how we can help conquer things like AIDS and diseases out there that help us as a society a lot more. I think, in my personal opinion, I would rather see my money go for that than I would a one-time rebate check that I can, go out and spend $150 on something. You know, down the long haul, I would prefer to have the research done to whereas if I were to come in contact, or wife, family, relatives, friends come in contact, or be, you know, have something like diabetes, to know that we've got, you know, research going on to help conquer something like that. And I think that's a more humanitarian thing to do with it.
Governor, before we get back to our callers, I'm reminded with the chilly weather, Governor Carlson won both kudos and criticism for closing the schools from time to time when it got particularly nasty. What's going to be your policy on that?
Well, you got to take it as what the weather is and make the call basically as you see it. I think everyone loves to hear the stories, but you know, it was funny, when I went to public school here for 13 years, kindergarten through 12th, they closed school one day out of those 13 years. And I don't think it's any colder today than it was then. And you know, the other unique thing, I used to have to walk to school uphill both ways.
I was going to say, now you're not going to start in with that nonsense. Right?
It's not nonsense. I even took my son and showed him how far I had to walk to Roosevelt High School my sophomore and junior year before I was old enough to have a car to do it. And he was pretty impressed. He said, "You really did walk that far." I said, "You darn right." Because there, in city schools then, Gary, there wasn't school buses. Mm-hmm. There was not any school buses whatsoever. You walked to school then. And so, but getting back to the issue, if it is hazardous to health, then I think you have to take that into consideration. But let's remember, we're Minnesotans. We should be able to dress and function in pretty tough style of weather. And so, and besides, wouldn't it be better to give the day off on a nice summer day?
Bob, your question for the governor?
Yeah, since you were just speaking of helping humanity, Governor, yeah. Are you aware that there are about 700 homeless people sleeping outside in the Twin Cities, and that the facilities provided for homeless male adults are grossly inadequate? My question, Governor, is if you are aware of the situation, what do you propose to do about it? Do you actually believe that the politicians should give all the budget surplus back without addressing and eliminating this disgraceful homeless problem?
Well,
just one minute. You know, Hennepin County Commissioner Mark Andrews,
very, very briefly,
the situation is completely inexcusable and immoral.
Well, first of all, we have charities, don't we? Yes, we do. We have charities out there that work in this industry that are out there to help people and do that. And and in giving the surplus back, well, you have to remember there are taxpayers out there that pay taxes. And they're entitled to some type of benefit too. And when they've been overtaxed or taxed beyond what it required to run the government, if you want to talk about that, then we need to put it into a budget. We need to address it in the budget, not take just because there's surplus money of overtaxation that it automatically goes to every special interest group in the world that has a cause out there. What about the cause of the average citizen that goes to work every day, holds down a job, supports their wife, their children, or it could be a working mother for that matter, an adult, supporting and doing their part of being part of society and paying those taxes? People forget that, you know, people are out there paying taxes and they need to be looked at too. You're dealing with other people's tax money also. And I realize homelessness is a problem. It needs to be addressed. But you also have to have people that want to help themselves. You can't help someone that does not want to help themselves. And I know it sounds a little harsh, but there are some people that choose to be homeless.
Do you see the state budget is growing at all, or pretty much fixed right where it is, and any increase in one area would have to be made up with by cuts in another area?
I see it as that very much. I see the budget growing only inflation, during this first budget time, because, and certainly inflation has to be factored in, because 80% of the budget goes to salaries of some sort. And, you know, you negotiate them and raises come in and you have to deal with it like that. But people need to remember the government is not charity. The government is not, you know, what rights do you really have out there? When you think about it, you have the right to something. You have the right to go out there, live free, and compete within our United States society. And the government is not a charity institution. The government is an institution that is paid for by other people's tax dollars. We have charities out there. And when the economy is good, charities tend to be good, too. So let's keep working on the economy. We have a strong economy. People are giving people. They will help out other people without government acting as a middleman.
In terms of the budget, you've talked about getting those class sizes down in education, and I know the teachers are interested in some substantial increases in the what's called a per pupil funding formula and the rest. Any idea where the money will come from to pay for that, for those
class
extra
sizes down? Yeah. It's already being allocated for it. It's been allocated for it for the last 3 or 4 years. It's just the problem is they made the allocation with loopholes in it.
But there's enough
where,
there's enough
the
money for that.
I feel very strongly in my budget coming up that we can shift things around and put that as a priority. Everybody has to remember something. You know, everyone has a wish list. And it would be tremendous if we all could have our wishes fulfilled. But if we fulfill everyone's wish list, well, then we're going to be paying probably 60-70% of our salaries to the government. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's right either. You know, so we have to set priorities. We have to do the things that we're capable of doing. And certainly a wish list does not mean a right list. You don't have a right to anything. You know, I don't mean you have the right to freedom, you have those type of rights, but you don't ever, you know, everybody, it's like, it's funny, it's like as a celebrity, you get approached by every charity in the world, and every charity is admirable, every charity is the most important one for that person that's talking to you, but you have to make a choice. And believe me, of one or two that you concentrate on, and you take care of that, and that's, in a way, that's the way it is in what I have to do. I have to set 3 or 4 major priorities to get done. And if you can accomplish that, you're doing well. You know, it's very hard to thin yourself out, and because then you end up doing a number of things, far too many things, and you don't do them well then.
Have you settled on those 3 or 4 priorities that
well,
are going to mark the Ventura administration?
Getting that class size down is extremely important, because I think that solves many of the other problems. See, you want to pick out the biggest problem that'll have the best trickle-down effect to solving the other problems. And in Milwaukee and in Tennessee and in these other places where they've gone to a legitimate 17-to-1 ratio, and when I mean legitimate, I mean walking into any classroom, K through 3rd is where you start, walking into any one of those classrooms, any school in Minnesota, and never seeing over 17 students per one teacher. And then I think you'll see the results. Education will pick its way up, test scores will start going up, but again, it's a generational thing.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to start and work its way into it.
Any other top priorities?
Top priorities, again, are holding the line on government spending. I think it was very, very clear in this election. You know, people have said, well, Jesse doesn't have a mandate because he only got 37% of the vote. True. But you'll find that my fiscal was very close to Mayor Coleman's fiscal. We weren't far apart on our fiscal, and if you add up his 34 with my 37, you come out with 71.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was very much, we were not far apart fiscally, because we believe in American people. We believe that people, if given the chance out there, and you almost move government out of the way as an obstacle, they will succeed. We just need to be there to support them in some manner so they can succeed, but not become their parents.
Anything else? Class size, hold the line on state spending, anything else that's going to, when we get done, we're going to say, well, that's what Jesse Ventura stood for.
Well, I think that also that being this surplus we've had and all that, I think cutting some of the taxes. There's, you know, I find it very interesting that you take the automobile, the license tabs. It's the only one we have that is based on a price. If you buy a hunting license, it's a flat fee. If you buy a fishing license, it's a flat fee. A motorcycle license is a flat fee. That drives on the same roads, right? A motorcycle. Yet they don't base that fee on, you know, what the price of the motorcycle was. You've already been taxed on the price of that automobile. A sales tax when you buy it. See, here you're buying the privilege to drive on the roads. And I don't think the value of the car should have very much of a bearing on what you pay for tabs to use those roads. I think that it should be much more of a flat rate type thing. And we've got a pretty creative method that I'm going to bring forward in this budget that I think people are going to enjoy, because the one thing you can do right now is you can write those fees off on taxes. We're going to be able to accomplish a much flatter rate and still get the benefit of writing off those fees. Killing two birds with one stone, if I might add that.
David, your question for the governor, please.
Yeah, I'm a township supervisor up here in northern Minnesota, Crystal Bay Township. And my issue I wanted to bring up was real estate taxes, because we've got a situation where people have lived here for a long time, even like old fishermen who lived along Lake Superior.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got developers coming in, buying land, price of the land goes up. And that old timer who's retiring, trying to, on that little plot of land that he had along Lake Superior, he can't afford to live there anymore.
Yeah, what was your name again?
David.
David.
Up here in Minnesota.
Okay, David, let me tell you this. And I sympathize up by Lake Superior, but guess what? It's going on like that all over the state.
Right, and
it's not just up there, because it happens everywhere development moves to.
And my point is there any way, you know, like taxes, you're taxed at the point of sale, and I don't understand why people are taxed.
Because your neighbor's property went up in value.
Right.
And why should you be taxed for improving your property?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, no, I fully understand. And here's what I'm going to tell you, David. Right now, my main key has been the budget, because you come in here as a newly elected governor and 25% new legislators, and you're faced with putting together a biannual budget before you've even got your feet wet. So I've got to focus on putting that budget together right now. When that is over, there'll be other sessions will come up down the road. Well, when we're done with the budget, that's when I can start turning to these other things. And I will tell you, over the next 4 years, my personal goal will be to do something with this property tax system that we have in the state of Minnesota to make it more equitable to people and to get it out of the quagmire it's in. It is just so complicated, so ridiculous. The politicians have made it that way, and we've got to do something to simplify it, make it fair, and make it absolutely to where people are not driven off their land because developers come into a certain area and they want to develop it. But you got to give me a chance on that one. Let me get the budget done, then I'm done with budgets for 2 years. I don't have to deal with budgets for 2 years. When that gets done, then rest assured I'm going to turn my attention to the property tax system, and we're going to do something with it. I hope those legislators are listening out there, because what you got happening now with this system is ridiculous. And the other message I want to send to legislators, and I want the people to send it to them, just because they're elected to do legislation doesn't mean they have to come over there with a big bucket full, basket full of more laws. We won't think any less of them by not creating more laws for us to live under. I mean, I was in the Secretary of State Joan Groh's office right before an inauguration took place, and on her wall, literally a whole wall, Gary, 5-6 rows high, are all the laws of the state of Minnesota. Now, how can they, you know, they tell you ignorance of the law is no excuse. How on earth can you use that as a formula to live by when it would require you to get a trailer and a truck to have all these laws and be aware of them all? You'd have to read these laws for the next year and a half just to be caught up on them.
A lot of people complain all the time about regulations.
Oh,
but
you know what else I'd like to see?
Which one do you want to, pick one that you want to whack here?
A regulation?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know off the top
or
of my head right now. I would like to make fireworks legal over 4th of July for adults.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the traditional way that we celebrate the birth of our nation, and it's kind of weird to me that I can go out and buy a 44 Magnum handgun, right, with a 7-day wait, because I have a clean record. I can go buy one, you know, and yet over the 4th of July, I can't buy a sparkler or a ladyfinger firecracker. Mm-hmm. If I want to throw one, but yet I can buy a 44 Magnum handgun.
As a private citizen, Governor, did you ever cheat on that law? I know you wouldn't do it as a governor, on
fireworks?
Yeah.
Occasionally. And I think I joined a lot of other Minnesotans that were, too. Up at my lake cabin this summer, there was at least 7 or 8 major spots around the lake that were... I mean, it was very nice, very enjoyable, and I felt very patriotic, to put it that way, on 4th of July. And I'm not saying, and the other point is, look at how Wisconsin is making a fortune off us right now. Because Wisconsin across the border sells all this fireworks, makes all the money, and who's buying it? The Minnesotans are. Because Wisconsin has a law that you have to get a license to shoot it yourself. So they are sitting over there. Tommy Thompson's a smart son of a gun. He's sitting across the border making a fortune over there off of us.
Doug, your question for the governor?
Good afternoon, Governor.
Hi.
Yeah, this is the Brownwater Sailor you talked to at the Becker County Fair last summer.
All right.
And all through your campaign, people asked, what makes you qualified to be governor? And there's one thing that people didn't realize, and that's the Navy motto, not self but service.
Yeah.
But my question is, and earlier it was brought up in your program about what can you do to keep people interested in government,
mm-hmm.
and keep that ball rolling? Well, be a good time to strip the hypocrisy from government and elected officials right now, and they've taken the oath to uphold the Constitution. Uptake all the laws that are going to be passed and the ones that have been passed, hold them up against the Constitution and see where we're at.
Very good.
A minute ago you said we have all these laws. Well, there'd be a lot less laws if they were held up to the constitutional value.
Okay, but you have to remember, too, though, times change, you know, sometimes, you know, and you have to adapt with those times and laws accordingly. And there are a lot of outdated laws. You know what, another one, Gary, now that it comes to mind, you ask me what I'd like to do. We need to decide when a person's an adult. We need to pick an age,
mm-hmm.
both federally, statewide, and locally. We need to pick that age, because right now, young men have to go register for the Selective Service at age 18. Now, in my opinion, if you're old enough to serve your country, you should be old enough to have a beer, to put it bluntly.
Mm-hmm.
If you're old enough potentially to give your life for your country, well, shouldn't you be an adult? Or do we send children to war? Is that our policy? Because if you're not old enough to drink a beer, and yet you're old enough to be drafted, you know, and we don't have a draft, but they still have to register for it.
Of course, if we lower the drinking age, then we lose a whole ton of federal highway money.
Well,
don't
then maybe we need to up the age of drafting young people. If they're, and I'm not saying which age is correct, but let's pick one. Let's get rid of the hypocrisy of what we've got going here, where, oh, it's good to have them adults at 18, but we're not going to give them the rights of adults at 18.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pick one. If it's 21, then fine. Young people shouldn't have to register for Selective Service until 21.
What seems like a good age to you?
I am 20.
Mm-hmm.
What about voting? We allow you to vote at 18. See, here you go. The hypocrisy of it again. We need to pick an age and say this is the age we recognize as being an adult. Maybe that's part of the mixed message these young people get. It's one of the most traumatic things I faced. I came back, I went through, enlisted in the Navy, went through a year being trained as a Navy SEAL, went to Southeast Asia, spent 9 months over there, came back to the United States of America, and could not walk into a bar if I wanted to. I was underage. I was in California. I was 21. I wasn't 21. I went into my executive officer and said, I want to go back overseas. He said, you can't. You've got to spend at least, no, he said, you've got to spend at least, you know, 9 months here back stateside before you can rotate. He said, why would you want to go back? I said, because over there, I'm an adult. Over there, no one's questioning me. I come back home, and all of a sudden, I'm a child. That's tough to take when you're in the military and you realize that you have the potential of giving up your life for your country, and yet your country won't even honor you with treating you like an adult. Is it that we send children off to do it?
Mm-hmm.
Let's pick that age.
I want to ask you this before we wrap up here, because you've come in for some substantial criticism of late for being too obsessed with money. Making movies, selling books. You've talked about
First Lady. I'm a capitalist. I've been obsessed with earning a living and going out and working hard my whole life, Gary. What's obsession about that?
But now you're the governor.
So?
Shouldn't you just devote all of your attention and time now to that?
I am. No one, and I've also devoted from November 3rd to today doing it without being paid. Do you get paid? How often do you come in here and do your show for free?
Mm-hmm.
Well, have I been working? Yes, I have. 12 to 14 hours. Now, let me finish. As far as the book deal goes, that's an autobiography of my life up until the election day.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a story that needs to be told that almost is even bigger than me in the story of the behind the scenes of how this all took place. I think it's very interesting. There is no movie deal. There's NBC's doing one unauthorized, apparently, without my permission. How about that? How come they're allowed to do that? They're allowed to make a movie of me. I have no input into it, no artistic input, and get nothing from it. So let's talk about this celebrity status where you lose your rights. If they did that to you, or if they did that to a regular citizen on the street, they'd get sued over it. But because I'm who I am, they can do it. And as far as the First Lady thing goes, I'm bringing that to the attention of the Minnesota public and the public of the United States because I find it blatant sexism. Cut and dried, end of story. Let's think for an example. Let's put up a hypothetical here. Let's say I was a widower or not married, okay? And I got elected governor. Who would run the residence?
Aren't there people who take care of that?
Yes, but who runs them? Who oversees them right now? The First Lady. Now, I'm single. I don't have a significant other. Who then would do it, Gary? We'd hire someone, wouldn't we?
So that's officially part of her responsibility?
Absolutely it is. Absolutely. Absolutely. Next point. Let's say May Shunk becomes the next governor after me.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say her husband Bill, he's an executive. He works a job. Does Bill have to leave his job to go run the residence? Would we do that to a man?
I wasn't aware that the spouse was required to do that.
Yes, they are. They are the person in charge of running the residence, overseeing it. And I'm not doing it just, and I'm not saying it
doesn't
has to
the,
come out.
Doesn't the governor? I mean, if that doesn't sound right.
The governor doesn't run it.
Yeah.
Governor doesn't run the residence at all.
Hmm.
I have nothing to do with that. The inaugural, guess who gets to do that? The First Lady puts together the entire inaugural, works with committees, but that's her responsibility. It's not mine. It's not the governor's responsibility. And my point being is, to me, it's, and I'm not saying that she has to be paid or compensated out of taxpayer dollars. They have a foundation that runs the residency and does that right now through donations, through all the improvement that goes to that building is not being done with taxpayer dollars. I'm just saying I find it very sexist that the female is expected to leave her job and take over a job and work 10 to 12 hours a day and not be paid for it. And what happens when they entertain on a state function? What about the incurred expenses that come in that? Would she greet the ambassador of Japan in Zubas in a t-shirt? That's my point. And what if the governor were single? Who runs it then? We'd hire someone. Someone would get hired to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is we've never had a single governor. But if that were the case, someone would... I can't do it. I don't have time to do that. I don't have any time to do that whatsoever. I can assure you of that.
Hmm. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately.
And my main thing is not to get my wife paid, Gary. My main thing is to bring certain things to light. And remember, you have a governor now and a first lady who come truly from the private sector. So this is new to us. And I'm simply reacting to what I'm watching and reacting to the way it's been mm-hmm. and what goes on. And I'm simply being honest and bringing it out to the public. And if I take criticism for it, so be it.
Think it's going to be fun?
Absolutely. I'm having fun right now. Absolutely. Hey, you're it's like anything. You've committed to doing the job. You might as well have some fun doing it. Jeez, if I get depressed now, I'm in a world of hurt.
People poking at you all the time?
Oh, yeah, but that's all right. I'm the boss now. Although sometimes you wouldn't know it when I get handed my schedule.
Governor,
he'll be there and away we go. Thanks, Gary, very much.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Reminder that programming at NPR is supported by the Twin Cities Food and Wine Experience. Valentine's Day weekend, Minneapolis Convention Center programs available at Lund's and Byerly's or 612-371-5857. Gary Eichten here. Thanks for tuning in today.